You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive Auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary. I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to Red Handed.
Yes, we have no headphones on because, once again, someone has fucked up the studio and it's not working. But we are putting our trust, our good faith...
in the audio gods.
In the audio gods and in your hands, dear listener. So,
and you're not here to listen to us complain about tech issues. You're here to hear us talk about some mental case.
Yeah, this is quite something. It's a potential fakey deathy, which I don't think we've done since Canoe Man.
No, and like people message us and they're like, oh, do DB Cooper. And I'm like, ugh.
No, never. I would rather sit on a hot grill.
Well, there you go. So no hot grill sitting today, but a possibly fakey death one. So let's do it. If we've learned anything over the past few years, whether it was the Paradise Papers, Trump, Wirecard, Putin's cronies, or, of course, Epstein's paedophile island, and this guy doesn't have the same name recognition as like a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. But this enigmatic billionaire certainly did change the world. And we're not going to bother today with how he did that. No, because today's episode is all about the lesser known events of this man's volatile and depraved private life. On the 21st of May 1995, billionaire American entrepreneur Larry Lee Hillblom took off in his tiny vintage two-engine aeroplane. He flew this little plane 450 nautical miles from the island of Saipan near Guam, where he lived, to Vietnam.
Guam is a US territory, so that is why he is there.
That makes sense. Now, despite being richer than God and having been in a plane crash a few years previously, Larry never really cared too much about servicing or maintaining his crappy vintage planes. Lightning doesn't strike twice, after all, does it? Hillblom certainly thought so. But on this day, it did. As the little plane's wheels left the runway and then banked over the Philippine Sea, the engine began to struggle, and Larry disappeared.
Days passed, with numerous rescue crews carefully scanning the Pacific for any sign of the plane or its passengers. Eventually, a few pieces of wreckage were discovered. And with those pieces of wreckage, the rescue crew found the bodies of Hillblom's pilot, 52-year-old Robert Long, and the body of Saipan Congressman Jesus P. Mafnas. Larry's body, however, was nowhere to be found. His family held out hope that he had survived and was just waiting to be rescued, but that day never came. Hillblom was 52 when he disappeared, and the head of a multi-billion dollar business, billion with a B. He never married, and as far as anyone knew, he had no children. But he certainly did have quite a lot of skeletons in his closet. A lot of them. And in the weeks following his disappearance, those skeletons were revealed for the whole world to see.
In his lifetime, Hillblom was described by many as a genius for his central part in making globalization possible. Anyone ever heard of the DHL Global Delivery Company? Well, the H in DHL stands for Hillblom.
Every day's a school day, hey?
Yeah, learning together. Exactly.
And I think, you know how a lot of people are like, oh no, I would hate to be famous, but they want all of the money and the power. This guy did it. Mm-hmm. He has, as we said, more money than God, and nobody knows who he is.
And that's the ideal situation. That's how you fly under the radar.
Yeah, he pulled it off, man.
Exactly. And you spin all of the webs. Spin webs? Is that what you do to webs? I don't know. Weave webs? Yeah,
you spin a web.
You spin a web. Spin the webs of power by not being directly in the public eye.
What's the saying when you're like, what a blank web we weave?
Tangled? Yeah, what a tangled web we weave. Sure.
Is that it? That doesn't feel right. I'm going to... Okay, that's what
a tangled
piss me off
web
all day.
We weave. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. So Larry helped found the world's largest courier system and all but transformed the way the world communicates. As well as founding a logistics empire, Larry also created one of the world's first word processors, owned two airlines, and was a Supreme Court justice. Who is this man? And he did all this while wearing dirty jeans, novelty t-shirts, and flip-flops. Though I am almost 100% convinced that when you are dealing with the real powers of Axis, they're not wearing a sharp cut suit.
Mm-mm.
They're dressed like college students.
They're wearing an hoodie with a puddle on it.
100%, 100%. I even went to just like a drinks reception that Hannah and I were invited to, but Hannah hurt her ankle too badly, so I just went to check it out, see who was there, you know, see if we could make any connections. When I got there, somebody introduced me to the owner of Novel, mm-hmm. which is a huge production company here in the UK who we are currently working with on a top secret project, which will be revealed very soon. The most unassuming man I've ever seen. Just like wearing a t-shirt, wearing a sweatshirt, wearing jeans. And I was like, you own Novel. Of course you do. Of course you do.
Because they have nothing to prove.
They have
They've
nothing
done
to
it.
Prove. Exactly. But despite all of these fascinating things and putting the H in DHL, it's where H put his D that he'll now be remembered for.
Nice.
When he disappeared, the question remained, why would a man from California, with such ungodly amounts of money, influence, and corporate responsibilities, live his days on a remote island in the middle of nowhere, just as his career was taking off? Well, it probably points to him being a bit of a wrong'un, but let's get into it.
Yes, I would like to clarify I was nicing the wordplay, not where yes. he put his penis. Born to Clarence and Helen Hillblum on the 12th of May, 1943, in Kingsburg, California, Larry Lee Hillblum was one of three brothers. His father, Clarence, died of heat stroke while roofing in Bakersfield.
Oh my God.
That's
my,
your biggest
that's
fear.
What I was going to say. That's my worst fucking nightmare. Oh my God.
Did you know you could die of heat stroke?
Oh, absolutely. Your body's just like, nope, I'm out.
I'm out. Wow.
I went to a Russian spa earlier this year and I genuinely thought I was going to die of heat stroke.
But then you were all euphoric and stuff.
But then I was very euphoric after, mm-hmm. probably because my brain was just like completely dehydrated.
We did it.
We did it. We survived.
Yeah, wow. He was roofing in Bakersfield during one of the hottest days of the summer, 1946.
Was the Great Depression during then? No, that was World War II.
No, the Depression was fought. The Depression was
yeah,
in the
20s. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So 46 was like, I was going to say that's such a Great Depression way to die, but...
It makes me think of that bit in The Shawshank Redemption when they're tarring the roof,
mm-hmm.
and Andy Dufresne gets beers for everyone and he doesn't even take one. Like, that's what it makes me think of.
Because he's dying of heat stroke.
It's too late for Andy Dufresne. He's got rivers of shit to swim through. Right. Okay, well, that's what I'm watching this evening. Oh, actually, so you know I told you about Guillermo del Toro's mm-hmm. Cabinet of Curiosity. There is a similar situation on Discovery Plus, which we got to watch Army Hammer.
Ah.
And it's all Eli Roth.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Eli Roth also has a new show, which I saw advertised when we were in Columbus for Obsessed Fest, called Help My Pet Is Possessed, or something like that.
He can't stop!
And I actually suggested that we watch that as like the ending of our Halloween Reacts video.
Oh, good
But
stuff.
I think Sophie was like, no. But it's got 2 out of 10 on IMDb. And let me read you the description.
Okay, please.
I know we're well off track, but this is just too perfect. And what Eli Roth is doing, I'm not totally sure, but maybe he's just like, I'm so rich now, I can do whatever the fuck I want.
Yeah, he's definitely got fuck you money now.
Okay, so Eli Roth has a new TV show called Eli Roth Presents, My Possessed Pet. And the premise of the show, which came out on September the 30th, 2022, owners tell terrifying tales of cherished pet relationships ripped apart by supernatural forces, evil spirits, demons, and curses taken over family pets. Sure.
Wow.
Oh, okay. It's gone up to 4 out of 10 on IMDb.
His sort of collection of stories, it's called Urban Legend.
This is also on Discovery Plus.
I'm such a big fan of Discovery Plus because it has 90 Day Fiancé UK, which you have to watch.
I am so going to watch.
Very similar.
Perfect.
And it's all Eli Roth, so there's a lot of... Might be a bit gory for you, actually.
Yeah.
But it's... It passed the time for me last night.
I do.
Anyway, back to Heatstroke. So Larry's dad dies when Larry is just 3 years old. So his mum raised him and his younger brother, Terry. They barely scraped by. And Helen earned money by cleaning her friends' houses. Helen was a tough woman whose biting wit and sarcasm were infamous in her community and apparently brought people to tears.
Bloody hell, Helen.
That's not wit.
No.
That's being a bully. And Helen Hillblum also had extremely high standards for her sons. From a very young age, Larry was raised in the Concordia Lutheran Church, of which Helen was one of the founding members. And it was in that church that she met a man named Andy Anderson.
Oh, just stop it. It's worse when you meet men who have got ridiculous names like that. Because I'm like, when your parents named you, they weren't assuming that you would change your surname. So they were like, this is fine. Andy Anderson.
Andy Anderson.
No.
Yeah, I get what you mean. And there was a kid in my year at Catholic school whose mum was called Carol Carol. But she married someone called Carol. And if you love, you love, you know. That's fine.
That makes sense. You know, you can't pick the surname of the person you fall in love with.
Yeah.
But you can pick the first name of the male child
Absolutely.
That you have.
And if you're Catholic, you can't really get away with keeping your own name either. So Carol Carol, I hope she's doing great.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Some of us are not naturally money people. And if you're not, it either means ignoring things and letting it all pile up around you, or spending hours staring at a spreadsheet every few weeks trying to make it all make sense. If you're doing the latter, let me give you back your time by telling you about Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money tracks your subscriptions and lets you unsubscribe with just a few taps. Plus, it automatically categorizes all of your transactions, helping you to organize it all and revealing your real spending patterns so you can set budgets, goals, and alerts. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/redhanded. That's rocketmoney.com/redhanded. rocketmoney.com/redhanded.
So Andy Anderson and Brad Bradley ran away at sea. No, they didn't. Andy Anderson married Helen Hillblum. Andy was a peach farmer. And it was from this stepfather peach farmer. Try saying that lots
that
of times.
That is great. Stepfather peach farmer.
Mm.
Can we start selling some like Stepfather Day merch? But not Stepfather Day.
Stepfather Day.
Father's Day for your stepdad merch. Stepfather peach farmer.
I'll get one for my stepdad. He'd fucking love that. So yes, stepfather peach farmer.
It sounds like, you know, when like guys in their early 20s wear like a bikini inspector or whatever.
Female body inspector.
FBI, female body inspector. And this is just like for your middle-aged stepdad. Stepfather peach farmer. It's just a picture of an ass or a peach on it.
Oh man, I wasn't sure where we were going to get the bum joke in, but I'm glad we did.
I'm here to provide.
The Lord will provide.
As said your stepfather peach farmer.
It was from this stepfather peach farmer that Larry learned the value of hard work and novelty t-shirts. Larry knew from a very young age that he wanted a lot more from life than being a stepfather peach farmer. The tiny enclave of Kingsburg, where the streets were empty and silent by 8 p.m, was hardly the right environment for a boy who'd one day shrink the globe. While at high school, Larry told his best friend, Someday, I'm going to move far away and I won't write you any letters. I'll call you once in a while, but I will not write any letters. Okay, Larry? Everybody who knew the young Larry said he was the hardest working person they knew at both school and at his stepdad's peach cannery.
Before leaving high school, Larry began reading the Wall Street Journal and investing in the stock market with the money that he earned from the cannery. Still in his teens, Larry bought himself a Corvette. And he had an unbelievable string of luck too, because Larry would win every single all-night poker game that he played. And even when they switched up and played dice games, which are absolutely by chance, there's no skill at a dice game, he'd still win those too. So Larry was either one of the luckiest people alive, or he was cheating. But as you'll come to learn, Larry loved his secrets, so it will never be 100% clear. Now, Larry's mother, Helen, was hugely proud of how her sons were turning out, but seemed to be completely oblivious to the odd contempt that Larry was forming for her. He'd say things like, "So she's done all these great things for me, the bitch."
Yeah, and he doesn't do it with any hint of sarcasm, like he means it.
No, yeah, I think when you're in the territory of calling your mum a bitch, things are probably not great between the two of you. But, you know, make of that what you will. So after high school, Larry moved out of the family farmhouse in Kingsburg and moved into an apartment in Fresno State, where he studied for his university entrance exams. Huddled under a blanket in a tiny freezing room without electricity, reading by candlelight, Larry managed to get himself accepted into the UC Berkeley Bolt Hall School of Law. It was the most prestigious university in the country at the time, but more importantly, it was worlds away from Kingsburg.
But conveniently in the same state, so he got in-state tuition fees.
Ah, smart. I like this guy so far.
So far, not terrible.
Yeah, he's like, I'm just going to work hard. I hate my mum for reasons, and I'm going to get myself into university and I'm going to get myself out of this peach cannery situation. And over the next few years, Larry would only return home a handful of times before finally deserting his family altogether for almost 25 years.
When Larry started law school, the thing that immediately struck his classmates was his appearance. He had strange bumps on his forehead, which he claimed were caused by a metal plate that was inserted into his skull after a car crash. But some people thought it looked like his face had been reconstructed. He had a number of tics and idiosyncrasies, including constantly parting his hair with his little finger, shaking his legs, and germophobic behaviour that included carrying disinfectant and his own ketchup everywhere he went.
Do you know what? A lot of that sounds like me.
I didn't want to say anything. But I'm glad you took the fall.
Yeah, anyone who spends any time with me knows that if my hair is down, I will constantly keep touching it. And I shake my legs all the time.
And you don't know you're doing it, which is the weirdest
thing. I don't know. So I 100% have restless leg syndrome. And it's not like me just being hypochondriac about it. Like I 100% do. And I looked it up and I was like, what are the causes of restless leg syndrome? Mm-hmm. Apparently iron deficiency, which I know I have. So
interesting.
There you go.
I have it because of my drugs. Never had it before. And it's when I lie down to go to bed. But I know I'm doing it because it annoys me and it keeps me awake.
I don't know I'm doing it. And actually, when somebody points it out and makes me stop, it feels really uncomfortable. Like my legs feel almost like they're aching, like I need to shake them.
Mm.
I always thought it was down to low blood pressure, but apparently it's down to an iron deficiency.
There you go.
So there you go. And I also do dabble in germophobic behavior.
Yeah, a germophobic dabbler over here. I wouldn't be surprised if I sat down at your restaurant and you had your own ketchup either.
Yeah.
It would probably be your own hot sauce, though.
No, I bought some new hot sauce today for the office, so you're welcome, everybody. I do have to confess. Would you like to know a confession from me, Hannah?
I'd love to.
I stole a bottle of ketchup from a pub, but 2 months ago. And I wasn't even drunk.
Was it a particularly nice bottle of ketchup?
You were just like,
I need this?
Well, I did. I felt like I needed it. So I was on holiday.
That's going to be covered in germs.
It would have been. I had had half a bottle of wine. So not smashed, but drunk enough to think that this was acceptable behaviour. I did leave them a tip, but it was just like a refill ketchup bowl. They'll be fine. But yeah, I was on holiday and it was like towards the end of the holiday. And I was like, it's been really annoying not having ketchup in the morning when I have breakfast. And I don't want to buy a bottle now because there are no shops near us. There's some ketchup here. Let's just take it. And then tomorrow, the bacon sandwiches in the morning will be less shit. So there we go.
That's true. I'm a brown sauce girl, so I find ketchup on bacon utterly despicable. But that is because my mum is from the north.
Well, there you go.
And that's just the way it is. Sometimes it do be like that. But yes, I hope you thoroughly disinfected it.
Yes. Yes. I felt quite disgusted the next day.
Well, I hope you had lovely bacon sandwiches. Right. So similarly, in another Saruti Bala vein, what stood out the most about Larry were his peculiar political beliefs.
I feel like Larry and me...
he's your soulmate.
I think he and I might be kindred spirits, to be perfectly honest with you. The crying, studying under a duvet, trying to get into, you know, be head girl and into university and, you know, all the shit that he's up to. I kind of feel like, so far, so good.
That's so funny. Larry Hillblom, head girl of whatever your school was called, Fern Hill. So you know, when we were outside at the Palladium show, this girl came up to me and she was like, I'm from Chesham and I've been trying to figure out where you went to school for years. You will never know. Anyway, Larry would have endless debates with his liberal peers.
Uh-oh.
He'd argue, for example, that the number of soldiers dying in Vietnam was irrelevant when compared to the number of Americans killed in car accidents every year. Larry Hillblom had a very calculated outlook on life. He believed that all that mattered was success and achieving one's personal goals. And I am just going to move straight on and not throw you under the bus. Larry, the law student, was obsessed with Mao Zedong and Howard Hughes. Very different men.
Mm.
And he loved them for different reasons. He loved Mao for his coldness and dedication to gaining power. And he loved Hughes for his reclusive nature.
But his idols weren't giving him any money. And neither were Larry's family. So in his second year of law school, Larry accepted a full-time job as a courier for a small Los Angeles law firm called Michaels, Poe & Associates. At the time, the only way to have important documents sent across the country was by way of the United States Postal Service, which could take weeks to deliver your package, assuming that it got there at all. And I'm sure everybody knows this, but the saying going postal, which we don't use in this country, but obviously Americans use, is because someone who works in the US Postal Service like went into work one day and shot everybody because I think things were just like run so badly and he was so miserable. Not that I'm excusing that behavior.
Do you know what I learned the other day on TikTok, where I learn everything?
Mm.
You know, to boycott, the verb. Mm-hmm. It's named after someone called Mr. Boycott, who everyone hated.
Oh, well, I don't what think a legacy. Because, yeah, you have to remember, like, this feels crazy today, the idea that the only way to get documents across the country was to courier them and it could take absolutely weeks to get there. But you have to remember that this was the mid-60s.
I think we forget about it because of the age that we live in. But the process of globalization was exactly what we said earlier, mm-hmm. shrinking the globe.
Yes.
It is, if you actually think about it, it's fucking mental that if I pay enough money, I could have something in China by the end of the day.
Yeah. But at the time, the only alternative to the Postal Service was to literally jump on a plane and deliver those documents by hand. And that was Larry's job. Every afternoon after class, Larry picked up important documents from insurance companies, law firms, and banks in the Bay Area and jumped on a plane north. He'd get the majority of his studying done in the air, hand the papers to a courier waiting at the airport, and then get on the next flight to Oakland to make it back just in time for his morning classes. You know what?
So far, I'm really impressed with
him. I'm super pro Larry so far. Obviously,
it won't last.
But this explained why Larry looked perpetually disheveled, dirty, and sleep deprived, and why his, you know, student peers were noticing that. He basically lived off coffee and speed. But it didn't matter to him. He slept in his car on weekends and was on a plane every night on weekdays. So that he didn't need to spend any money on an apartment. It was a win-win. By 1969, it was clear to Larry that there was a gaping hole in the market for a reliable, fast courier service that would save companies time and money. And one day, a chance encounter in a supermarket car park between Larry and a sales associate from MPA, that's Michaels, Poe & Associates, called Adrian Dolzy, changed everything. It had also dawned on Dolzy that there was a huge gap waiting to be filled, and the pair realized that they needed one another to make the business work. The two of them were polar opposites. Dolzy was a well-groomed, suited, smooth-talking 50-year-old, and Larry was, well, Larry. But it worked. Larry was young, full of ideas and energy and speed and coffee, and was more than happy to work 20 hours a day. And Dolzy had the credit cards and the connections to make it all work. And in September 1969, the same year man first walked on the moon, Larry and Adrian founded DHL. The D stood for Dalsey, H for Hillblom, and the L was for Robert Lynn, an investor friend of Dalsey's who had promised to help them raise capital. Lynn ended up dropping out of the company in the early stages, saying that it would never work, a decision he would almost definitely go on to regret, because DHL grew faster than any startup of its time.
Between 1969 and 1971, DHL's sales increased by almost 1,000%. They controlled 70% of the courier market between San Francisco and Hawaii, and over the next few years, they expanded to Asia. Also, Larry successfully managed to sue the United States Postal Service, meaning that their market monopoly was over. The courtroom win was a miracle, not just for DHL, but for other companies like FedEx. The young stepson of a Californian peach farmer was now heading up one of the fastest growing global corporations in history. But the problem was, Larry never wanted to be a high profile public figure. He wanted to be like his idol, Howard Hughes, a reclusive billionaire pulling the strings from behind the scenes and peeing into jars. And in the late 1970s, after a seemingly endless legal battle with the US government, Hillblom made his escape to paradise. He rented a home in Mauricio, a tiny village in the United States territory of Guam. Guam is not only a United States territory, it's a tax haven. And that tax haven would save Hillblom millions in capital gains taxes. That's the only reason anyone lives there. Grand Cayman, same thing, look it up. He later moved to the neighbouring island, Saipan, where our story started today. And there, Larry made himself at home. He bought the National Bank and served as a high court judge. But tax breaks and privacy weren't the only things that drew Larry Hillblom all the way out there. We're going to put a pin in it and come back to it.
Another thing Hillblom had in common with Howard Hughes was his intense fear of death. Like his idol, he was incredibly particular and the furthest thing from a daredevil that you can imagine. Which is why it was so strange that Larry Hillblom loved to fly his tiny vintage piece of shit aeroplanes that he never got serviced or maintained in the slightest. Not to mention the fact that he'd never even completed his pilot's license or had more than 5 hours of lessons.
That bit doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Because he's like, I can do anything, I'm Larry Hillblom. The not maintaining them is bizarre, because the one thing Howard Hughes did is he maintained the shit out of everything.
Mm-hmm. And in August 1993, 2 years before he went missing, Larry got into his 1960s Cessna 182 single propeller plane and took off from Saipan's international airport. He did this without carrying out any of the standard checks that pilots are taught to do. As a result, the engine stalled mid-flight, the plane crashed, and he landed upside down on the neighbouring island of Tinian. Larry suffered huge gashes to his face and had to undergo major facial reconstructive surgery. But miraculously, he was otherwise totally fine. Following his recovery, Larry's famous words were, "Now I don't need to worry about another aeroplane crash, because the odds of getting into two in the same lifetime are so remote, it's never going to happen again."
Probably more likely if you're not looking after your plane.
Yeah, Larry, I'm going to say that maybe with that crash, some of your logical thinking went out of the window, because just being like, well, after I've had this drunk driving incident, it doesn't matter how pissed I am behind the wheel of this car, because it's never going to happen again.
And this is where Sarita Bala and Larry Hillblom become no longer friends.
This is where we part ways, Larry. Because of course it did.
So let's fast forward, knowing what we know, to May 22nd, 1995, which is the day we started the episode. The day that Larry Hillblom disappeared off the face of the earth. And as we said, the body of the pilot and the other passenger were recovered, but Larry was nowhere to be found. After some time, it was presumed that Larry had died and his body had sunk to the bottom of the ocean. You would expect that a man worth $500 million who had attended one of the most prestigious law schools in the United States would at the very least have a comprehensive will in case of his untimely demise. But not Larry. It seemed as though Larry Hillblom didn't give a single shit what happened after he died. All he really said in his 11-page will was that he wanted a huge chunk of his money to go to medical research at the University of California. There was no mention of how to divide the remaining capital amongst his family. And that was about to start an enormous clusterfuck, as I'm sure you can imagine. The will named the Bank of Saipan, which, remember, Larry owned as the executor of his estate. So he essentially makes himself the executor of his will. But with Hillblom gone, the majority shareholder of the bank would be in charge. And that man was called Joe Wachter. So keep up. Larry's dead. Bank now belongs essentially to this Wachter character, and he is the executor of the will. Wachter was sure that he was quids in on Hillblom's fortune. But then he heard from someone he didn't expect. An 11-year-old Pelion boy called Junior Larry Hillbroom. You heard that correctly. Junior had his last name misspelt at the hospital when he was born, and it was never changed.
The boy's mother, Kalani Kinney, claimed that she'd been in a relationship with Larry Hillblom when she was just 16 years old in the early 80s, and that Larry had ended things with her after she got pregnant. Junior Larry Hillbroom had grown up in a tiny home on one of the Pacific's most remote islands with barely a penny to his name. But on the wall of his shack was a framed photo of Larry Hillblom, one of the richest men on the planet, who he had been told his entire life was his father. Kinney came forward to sue for paternity on behalf of her son. Wachter held a press conference. He announced that Kinney was lying and that Junior Larry Hillbroom was not Larry's son. And he framed her as a money-grubbing stranger that was trying to take advantage of a dead man's estate. Of course, the responsible thing to do would have been to hold a paternity test before making any definitive public statements like this. But that just wasn't Wachter's style. Joe Wachter had been working for DHL since he was in college and had been made president of DHL by Larry himself. And although Larry hadn't left him any money in the will, Wachter felt that he was entitled to a slice of the pie. And as a trustee, he was legally entitled to any profits generated from the assets. So it was in his best interest to preserve Larry's billion-dollar trust. This was no joke. And now, here was this random woman from a rural village in Palau, threatening to take away a huge chunk of what Wachter felt that he was owed. And he wasn't going to go down that easy.
Enter David Lujan, a criminal lawyer from Guam, who took up the case to represent Junior Larry Hillbroom. Lujan was certain that Kinney was telling the truth about her son, not least because it had been something of an open secret on the island for years. While Hillblom lived on the island, people would joke with him that he had a son down the road, and he would simply respond with a nervous chuckle and brush those jokes off as just rumours. Lujan felt it was his responsibility to defend a helpless child and get him his birthright, but this was very much David going up against Goliath. Lujan was up against an army of big-time American lawyers with a seemingly endless supply of funds and resources, and they thought that they had nothing to fear from the tiny island of Saipan. On top of that, the fact that Hillblom's body was never found worked in his lawyer's favour, because that meant there was no DNA to test the boy's legitimacy. So then there wasn't a case to be made. And obviously every member of the Hillblom family refused to offer a sample of their own DNA, plus, legally, there was no way to force them to do it. The only remaining option for Lujan was to attempt to recover Larry's DNA from somewhere else. The judge ordered Wachter not to clean or disturb anything in Larry Hillblom's home until it had been searched. Obviously, the hope here is that the prosecution would be able to collect a DNA sample from Hillblom's house. But when Lujan and his team arrived at the home, the entire property had been ransacked. There wasn't a single picture, item of clothing, hair, or speck of dust left in the entire house. It seemed as though even the plumbing had been cleaned. There was absolutely no evidence that Larry Hillblom had ever set foot in the house in which he lived.
So had Larry Hillblom fathered a child in Saipan?
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive Auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Some of us are not naturally money people. And if you're not, it either means ignoring things and letting it all pile up around you, or spending hours staring at a spreadsheet every few weeks trying to make it all make sense. If you're doing the latter, let me give you back your time by telling you about Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money tracks your subscriptions and lets you unsubscribe with just a few taps. Plus, it automatically categorizes all of your transactions, helping you to organize it all and revealing your real spending patterns so you can set budgets, goals, and alerts. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/redhanded. That's rocketmoney.com/redhanded. rocketmoney.com/redhanded.
It's not impossible, especially when you consider his habits while on the island. And this is where things get gross. Because according to his mates, Larry had no interest in buying fancy cars or big houses. He was only interested in young women. Even uttering, "Why would I spend $100 on dinner? I'd rather spend it on pussy." Now, others close to him have also said that Larry had a particular penchant not just for young women, but for girls who'd been trafficked in from extremely rural, remote areas of Southeast Asia. James Scurlock, author of King Larry, The Life and Ruins of a Billionaire Genius, puts it this way. Dabbling in local waters had been a favoured pastime of colonists for centuries.
Vom.
And Larry Hillblom was no different. You could say, in fact, that he was significantly worse. At the time of Hillblom's disappearance, he was living with a girlfriend, Josephine Nokasa. He met Josephine at a bar in Saipan called Poppy's Nightclub. Poppy's was run by a Korean woman who'd fly in young girls, often underage, from the Philippines to be dancers, models, or GROs, or guest relations officers. Essentially, they were sex workers. These young girls would often be sold by their families to an agent, who in turn would sell them to a bar to carry out sex work. And this is very tricky territory because, again, it's like, if you're there against your will and you've been trafficked, it's not really sex work. You're just like a slave who's being raped. So I think there is a distinction there, but just so we're clear about what's happening, basically.
Many of these girls were as young as 13. And for more on these sinister markets, you can go and check out our episode on Richard Huckle, which is a real deep dive. And a friend of mine came to our Palladium show and she said she was driving up from Bournemouth with her boyfriend. And she was like, "Oh, we should listen to it on the way up." And he was like, "I draw the line at listening to an episode about a paedophile." And then obviously came to the show, which was about a paedophile. Sorry. Right. Check out our Richard Huckle episode. You can learn all about it. Let's get back to Poppy's Nightclub. At Poppy's Nightclub, for a fee, the paedophile clientele would take trafficked young girls on a quote-unquote date. And that is how Larry met Josephine when she was just 16. What he liked the most about Josephine was that she was still a virgin. Poppy's Nightclub charged extra for a virgin. They had something that they called a cherry fee, which is quite literally the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. Hillblom once bragged to his friends that he'd spent as much as 10 million in cherry fees and had slept with 132 virgins. Most of them, we can safely assume, were way underage. We already know lots of things about Hillblom, and the main things are he was a total piece of shit, he was a germaphobe, and he was also terrified of dying. He truly believed that the only way to avoid contracting AIDS was to sleep with virgins and virgins only, and that's what he did. God forbid he should buy a condom. This is vile, but to my head, so it has to be in your head too. One of the ways Hillblom would vet his conquests was to bring them back to his hotel bathroom and show them the shower. If the girl knew how to operate the shower, he took that as a sign that they had done sex work before and he would kick them out. and his germophobia even meant that he would drip iodine down his penis after having sex to kill any germs.
Oh, God. Just to be clear, Larry Hillblum and I have parted ways quite significantly now.
Just buy a condom, my God, that's so much simpler. Anyway, eventually, Hillblum hired Josephine as his maid to get her out of Poppy's nightclub, and she became his live-in girlfriend. But that didn't stop him sleeping around with as many young girls as he could physically get his hands on behind Josephine's back. I would be amazed if Josephine didn't know.
By the time Larry disappeared, Josephine had been living with him for almost 10 years, but she never had any money of her own, and she wasn't mentioned even once in Larry's will. So Josephine filed her claim for a slice of Larry's fortune. And as time went on, a few more women came forward too, claiming that their children were Larry's. These women were met with elitist, racist remarks from the media. Headlines questioned why these women from rural villages should be given millions of dollars and what they would even do with the money. A rumour began to circulate that while Larry was alive, Joe Wechter and another associate had advised him to put a stipulation in his will to disinherit any offspring that he may have. Larry, however, had refused to do so. And this led many people to speculate that he was fully aware that he had children out there and didn't want them to be disinherited. During his time as a High Court judge, Larry Hillblum had passed a law supporting the inheritance rights of children. And during his time as a High Court judge, Larry Hillblum had actually passed a law supporting the inheritance rights of children born out of wedlock, almost as though he was writing laws specific to his particular situation.
It's nice when you own the National Bank and are a Supreme Court judge and can do whatever you want, basically. Meanwhile, Junior's criminal lawyer David Lujan was working tirelessly combing through the financials of the Hillblum estate. He was convinced that there was something fishy about how Joe Wechter came to be the executor of the will in the first place. And David Lujan was right. He goes on to be right quite a lot. Wechter had manipulated Hillblum's assets in order to take control of the entire estate. It's convoluted and fucking boring, but basically, Wechter borrowed money from the estate to pay for shares in the Bank of Saipan, which Larry had allocated to be the executor of his estate, which we already know. In simple terms, this is what he did. It's like me wanting to buy 40% of Saruti's stuff and borrowing money from Saruti to do that. It makes no sense. It's fucked. Wechter's plan clearly was to take over the bank in order to take over Larry's assets in their entirety. So, once Lujan brought this mess to light, the judge kicked Wechter off the case and suspended the National Bank. And while they were doing that, $8 million of missing assets were recovered. But somehow, the state attorney general from California, which has absolutely the fucking nothing to do with any of this, reinstated Wechter. And I can hear you, and I am answering your question, why was the state attorney general of California sticking their oar in? Well, because the University of the State of California had been assigned $1 billion in Larry's will. So the state of California actually had quite a lot to lose. And when these women with their silly paternity claims were sticking their oar in, the University of California were worried that their money was in jeopardy.
The case was on the news around the world. And once people understood that there were girls out there with a claim to tens of millions of dollars, many scrambled to find their lottery ticket. Private detectives were hired to go around Saipan and Manila's infamous sex clubs to find out if there were any more of Hillblum's illegitimate children out there, so that their client could represent the mothers. Now, to be fair to them, this was very likely. And they started this sort of hunt for heirs by going from club to club with posters of Larry's face and telling girls that they stood to make a lot of money if their child was Larry's. And this is how one PI found 15-year-old Mercedes Feliciano, who came from Paranaque, one of the most deprived slums in Manila. Mercedes was 8 months pregnant at the time. She told investigators that Hillblum had met her when she was just 14 years old at a bar in Manila. She had been sent there to work by her mother, who needed the money to take care of her blind sister. After he met her, Hillblum had negotiated a price for Mercedes' virginity with her mother in a KFC near the bar. When Larry found out that she'd gotten pregnant, he promised to return and marry her one day. To his friends, Larry referred to Mercedes, 15-year-old Mercedes, as the Benz.
Hate. Loathe entirely.
Yeah. So the private investigator who found Mercedes locked her up in his apartment as his prisoner and pawn in the Hillblum case. There was a deadline approaching for heirs to be able to make a claim on Larry's estate, and this PI wanted the baby born before the deadline. So he attempted to pressure Mercedes into having a cesarean section months before the baby was due, in order to see if the baby looked half Caucasian. Fortunately, Mercedes' mother managed to rescue her from the apartment, and they came forward of their own accord. And that entire time, Mercedes was never even informed that Larry Hillblum was dead. She still thought that he would come back one day and marry her, as he'd promised.
It's so easy to feel like you shouldn't be doing anything fun until you deserve it. Has it ever struck you that maybe you don't feel like doing anything because you've been doing things for ages, like years? How often do you put off doing something you enjoy just because you feel like you haven't earned it, you haven't done enough today? Well, it is now time to throw that caution to the winds and start adding a bit of fun whenever the mood strikes you with Best Fiends. I've said before how much I enjoy breaking up the day with a few levels of Best Fiends. I work in hour-long blocks and I need 10 minutes off or my brain just shuts down. If I'm quick enough, I can even get a round done in the lift from the office to the recording studio, which makes you feel like a ninja. Actually, it's probably my daily indulgence with Best Fiends that has got me to level 573. Best Fiends is now a free-to-download mobile puzzle game with thousands of exciting levels. Best Fiends, as I'm sure you already know, is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game with thousands of exciting levels for new adventures and challenges every single time you play. There are dozens of unique fiends to collect, so you can customize your team of fiends to defeat menacing slugs. You can power up your favorite fiends to new levels for even more powerful skills and watch them transform as they get stronger. Plus, with offline play, you'll never be stranded without the fun, even if you lose your internet signal. The best thing is brand new events and challenges pop up all year round, so you've always got a chance to earn exclusive in-game items, characters, and rewards. So accept that you've earned your fun time. Go to the App Store or Google Play to download Best Fiends for free. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends, without that R, Best Fiends.
Another young woman called Julie Guadero had a similar story. She told investigators that Hillblum had met her at a club when she was 15, taken her back to his condo, and raped her on an air mattress. When he found out that she was pregnant, Larry gave her $200 and told her to get an abortion. But instead, she fled back to her grandparents' house in the provinces. So at this stage in our story, there were 8 teenage mothers claiming that Larry was the father of their babies. But there was still no way of proving the legitimacy of their claims without DNA. So the idea of testing the children's DNA against each other's to prove siblingship was floated about. This was a precarious plan. If a number of the mothers were lying, then the legitimate children's cases would be significantly weakened. So Lujan refused to go for it. Then, suddenly, news arrived that Hillblum had had a mole removed during a facial reconstruction surgery after his first plane crash. And that mole was being held in state like Lenin for some reason by the Davis Medical Center in San Francisco. Isn't that lovely and convenient? And this presented a very real chance of getting Hillblum's DNA. Lujan, in yet another edition of Lujan Gets It Right, was suspicious. The Davis Medical Center also stood to benefit from money coming to them from Larry's will. Millions, actually. When the day came to hand over the mole, this is farcical, a doctor in a white lab coat arrived in a room full of lawyers holding a small tissue specimen in a plastic container.
I hate this. The idea of just a dismembered mole.
Yeah, blech. Just flopping around. But Lujan, because he is a smart cookie, noticed that something was off. The container that had the floppy mole in it, was labelled DMC69755. But the original pathology report that Lujan had seen had the sample number DMC69775. Lujan pointed this out and then the pathologist ran out of the room.
Oh my God. This is unbelievable.
It's a farce. Mm-hmm. Then the doctor comes back shortly with a different sample in another plastic container, correctly labelled, one would assume, and he threw it on the table saying, "Here's Larry."
Oh my God. Stop it.
Oh God. The Davis Medical Center was and is famous for its precision, as one would hope for a medical centre. And the whole thing just did not sit with Luhan.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's being conducted by a place that is famous for its precision.
No, it's not sitting well with me either. Luhan had a feeling that the DNA from the floppy mole was not Larry's at all. He didn't trust the bit of mole or the white-coated doctor, in inverted commas, from the medical centre.
So shortly after, Luhan woke up to the news that somehow a new probate law had been passed in the North Mariana Islands. It was dubbed the Hillblom Law, and it stated that illegitimate children had no legal right to claim an inheritance. Is this Game of Thrones? What's happening? And it also worked retroactively.
That's nice.
Yep. So surprise, surprise, it turned out that the entire thing had been engineered by none other than Joe Wichter. This was Wichter's checkmate. For Luhan, this meant war, and he went after them with a vengeance. About a week later, Larry's mother had been hospitalised for high blood pressure, and there was a rumour that a nurse had come into her room and taken a swab from inside her cheek. But the hospital had no record of any nurse doing any such thing. Shortly after, Luhan phoned his team and told them that he knew with scientific certainty that Junior Larry Hillblom was indeed Senior Larry Hillblom's son. But he did not elaborate on how he knew. Luhan then went to the media, and NBC and Dateline ran a special story on Larry Hillblom, including an interview with Junior Larry Hillblom. The world learned of the penniless Palawan boy, who'd been born 9 months after Larry visited the island, and his mother, who was just 16 years old when she slept with Larry. The Dateline host also interviewed Wichter's right-hand man about why they were fighting so hard to disinherit Larry's alleged heirs. He was squirming and sweating throughout. It's very much like a Prince Andrew in the Channel 4 interview. Or was it BBC? Dateline also told the story of 14-year-old Mercedes and how Hillblom had paid her family $2,000 for her virginity.
After this media assault, the tides began to turn. Luhan went through every single legal bill from Wichter's team's expense accounts, and he stumbled upon a $160 charge for muriatic acid, which is also known as hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid can be used to degrade strands of DNA. So Luhan knew immediately why the plumbing had been so squeaky clean at Larry Hillblom's house in Saipan. Wichter and his team must have poured hydrochloric acid down the drains to destroy any evidence. And that is a felony. So this was a huge breakthrough for Luhan and Larry's kids. And what happens next is just as shocking, if not unsurprising. Josephine Nokasa, Hillblom's girlfriend, came forward and she told Luhan that she had been asked by Wichter to burn every single thing Larry had owned before the place was searched. She was not having it, she thought it was entirely immoral, so she hired an excavator to dig a pit in the garden and buried it all instead. Wichter denied this, obviously, and testified in court that Josephine had in fact thrown away Larry's belongings of her own accord as some sort of Filipino mourning ritual, which is very patronising. So Luhan and his team hired an excavator operator and had him dig up Larry's entire backyard, but they couldn't find anything. And suddenly the operator, who hadn't been told why he was digging everything up, said, "Are you guys looking for where I buried the clothes?" It turns out he was the only excavator operator on Saipan, and he had been the one who had buried the stuff in the first place.
Oh my God, brilliant.
And this guy led the team to the spot where he had buried all of the clothes, and they uncovered everything from this hole, including Larry's t-shirts and jeans, to his hairbrushes, combs, toothbrushes, and his socks.
Brilliant.
So finally, Luhan and his team had everything they needed to test the children's paternity.
A dirty little DNA time capsule.
Yeah.
Gross.
That's the name of your autobiography.
Can't wait. So of the 8 children whose DNA were tested against Larry Hillblom's, 4 returned as positive matches. Luhan proved that Larry was definitively the father of Junior Larry Hillblom, along with 2 other children from the Philippines and another in Vietnam. He's like a shit Genghis Khan.
Yes, yes, exactly.
But instead of war, he just rapes children. So Luhan and his team called them the Lucky Sperm Club.
Don't love that from you, Luhan. Loving the rest of your work. But the Lucky Sperm Club. I'm sorry, you're on your own with
Merch?
That one.
Merch?
Merch!
And whether we like that name or not, lucky they were. Because each child was now entitled to $90 million in inheritance from Larry's estate. And thanks to Lujan, they got it. Now, I wish I could say this was a happy ending for all of the kids, but sadly, that's just not the case. After the settlement, Junior Larry Hilbrum became one of America's richest teenagers and was catapulted from a poverty-stricken life in Palau into a world of private schools and endless wealth. In 2005, at the age of 21, Hilbrum was arrested on alleged drug charges and for attempting to bribe an officer in Guam. The judge ordered him to go to a drug recovery center, but it didn't work out. And the rest of his 20s were filled with alcohol and crystal meth abuse. And in early 2016, he was again arrested for having two female associates smuggle 160 grams of crystal meth into Palau for him. At this point, Junior Larry Hilbrum had squandered most of his $90 million inheritance and only had around $10 to $15 million left.
That seems impossible to me.
I know. How? But just earlier this year, in February 2022, at the age of 37, Hilbrum was sentenced to 8 years in prison for the smuggling charges.
Sad.
What a fucking waste of the Lucky Sperm Club.
As for Larry Hilbrum Sr., his body has never been found. Although he has been officially pronounced dead, many still speculate that Larry is alive somewhere on an island, hiding out with Elvis, Epstein, and Tupac.
Who knows?
Be a good way to go.
It would. Got enough money for it.
I just want him to be like debating socialism with Tupac.
So yeah, that is it, guys. That is the story of Larry Hilbrum, the man who put the H in DHL.
There you go. There you have it. Learning the stuffs.
Absolutely. So yeah, we hope you enjoy it. And we will see you next time.
Actually, I'm going to fake my death and move to an island so I'm not seeing any of you.
Oh no. Bye.